Rappin' with Reef Bum is sponsored by Champion Lighting and Supply, Polo Reef, and Fauna Marine.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of Rappin' with Reef Bum. I'm your host, Keith Berkelhammer. So, on tonight's live stream, I welcome back Chris Wood from Captivate Aquaculture. What's going on there, Chris, man? Good to have you back.
Thank you very much for having me.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Chris. I learn a lot from these talks, and I'm sure all the folks out there watching agree. Very, very informative stuff. So just a little background on Chris. He is a marine biogeochemist and the chief science officer of Captivate Aquaculture. He is also the founder and sole owner of Captivate, the company's R&D draws from Chris's experience and two additional scientists. Is that still the case with a total of four PhDs on staff?
Yes.
Okay. Chris entered the aquatics industry in 2000 as a marine scientist and product development and support specialist, and since that time has worked with Aquarius and organizations throughout the world to improve outcomes with aquarium systems and recirculating aquatic ecosystems. Some of the organizations that have used his formulations include the Smithsonian Institute, Disney, NASA, and the Israeli government, as well as several aquaculture operations in the U.S., including ACI Aquaculture. I see that Mr. Chris Meckley is in the house, and Mr. Meckley will be on the show next week. Before we start chatting with Chris, I want to make sure I take care of some of the business here and thank the sponsors of this show. My sponsors are really important because they make this show possible with their support, and that means a lot since I want to continue to bring you awesome guests to help foster a learning environment on the show. Champion Lighting and Supply, besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through their website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. They do sell Captivate Aquaculture products. Polo Reef. Make sure to check out Polo Reef's new YouTube video that drops this Friday. Imagine winning a fully paid trip to New York to see the 17,000-gallon reef in person. Well, that's exactly what just happened. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polo Reef for video drop notifications. Polo Reef is known for some crazy giveaways, so make sure to follow their socials as well. And my third sponsor is Fauna Marine. I do use the Fauna Marine Reef ICP Total Test Kit, which gives a quick, accurate, and easy overview of over 90 water values in reef aquariums. From macro elements to trace elements and pollutants, you get a complete overview, corresponding dosage and action recommendations. I am now a certified Fauna Marine ICP test advisor, so if you want some help interpreting your results, then select me. All right, so with all that stuff out of the way, Chris, man, how's it been going? Busy?
Good.
Busy?
It's the typical summer slowdown, which is nice, okay. Because for about 6 months there, I didn't have a day off, and I was not happy about that. So, yeah, it's nice to have a little bit of quiet time right now.
Yeah, no, for sure. So, all right, man, let's get into a few of the topics here that I wanted to cover, and one is ammonia dosing. You know, it seems to be a very popular topic these days, and I had both Sanjay and Mike on the show talking about it, you know, that they're dosing ammonia bicarbonate. Chris Meckley, though, I know, is dosing ammonium chloride at this point. You have developed your own ammonium bicarbonate product. According to the theory on ammonia dosing, the corals consume it much faster versus nitrate, so it's more digestible, so to speak. It's consumed with less energy by the corals versus nitrate. Nitrate requires two reactions, and ammonia requires one. I mean, is that kind of like your understanding there, Chris, in terms of the benefits of ammonia dosing versus nitrate dosing?
It's fairly well established. I would say it's extremely well established in the literature that plants make better use of ammonium as a nitrogen source than nitrate, and when given the option of ammonium versus nitrate, they will tend to select ammonium as a nitrogen source. Now, that being the case, they will not then reduce the nitrate in their immediate surroundings. Instead, they'll be reducing the ammonium. So if there's, or taking the ammonium up, consuming it. So it That's basically what it's all about. It's easier. There's less work involved for the plant. There's an unhealthy level of taking that whole thing, though. And this is, I think, where you've gotten a bit of the opposing view from other people.
Yeah, Charles Delbeek mentioned that, there is a lot of literature out there that's conflicting in terms of what the effects are actually doing. And you know, I guess the question is, are there risks over time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I would put ammonium dosing in the same general category as dosing potassium or sodium hydroxide for most individuals maintaining a smaller aquarium system. It can lead to a disaster if there's an overdose. I can understand Mike, Paletta, and Sanjay going this direction, because not only do they, between the two of them, or individually, have decades and decades of experience with reef aquarium husbandry, and they've got large systems, and but the bigger thing is their experience, and also they have scientific background. They have I believe, as far as I know, that to be the case, they're able to think about things on a level where they're going to progress into a new area cautiously. They'll know what to look for as far as warning signs are concerned. They're not going to try and push an envelope to be the first person to achieve something and to say, hey, look, now I'm using this other thing here. Because there are inherent risks with ammonium dosing. The smaller the system is, for sure, the more difficult it is to really control what you're putting into it. And if you're going to dose with an ammonium product, then you need to really pay attention to the instructions, and you need to follow the instructions to begin with.
Right. So this is like not something for somebody that just started a tank that's got a few frags in it or something like that, a young tank. You know, I mean, those guys have well-established reef tanks. And I see Meckley is saying that he's now dosing ammonium bicarbonate. Yeah.
He's using mine.
Your stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So with some of the larger commercial aquaculture systems that I've done in the past, and those systems get started with ammonium chloride traditionally as a nitrogen source. That's to get the system kickstarted. And those systems are, they tend to be scrubber dependent more than bacterial dependent as far as nutrient control is concerned. And when you're running a system and you've actually put livestock into it, at that point in time, the ammonium dosing more or less stops. When you are growing a cohort of organisms in a system that rely on nitrogen and you don't have enough nitrogen in there, that's one thing. But in the beginning with a new system, that generally isn't the case. It's a while until nitrate concentrations that are present at the end of the initial cycle start to drop down into concentrations and into ranges where now you start looking at it and thinking, okay, I'm down at 5 parts per million nitrate, and you know, I'm happy with that, or I'm down at 10 or whatever the number is. It's not until you start running really, really nitrogen limited in a system that I think you want to start even looking at ammonium. And in that situation, you better read the directions.
Yeah, I see Chris is saying that you guys have talked about ammonia dosing, and you suggested to him perhaps to start very conservative, and he's actually he said, in only 2 weeks.
Yeah, and this is a unique set of circumstances for Chris, because he's running a full-scale aquaculture facility that's raising zooxanthellate corals almost exclusively. And that being the case, there's a massive demand for nitrogen in a system like that. And these are large systems. This is not somebody's 250-gallon living room reef tank. This is a system that's you know, 30 times that by the time everything is all said and done. I mean, it's just, they're huge systems. So in a commercial application, it makes it makes more sense. It's safer because you can get away with a slight hiccup. I don't find that to generally be likely in a really small system.
So if somebody is trying to get a handle in terms of the nitrate dosing, or you know, trying to manage nitrates right in their tank, and they've got I don't know, let's say you've got some very high nitrates in the system, so that kind of situation is not going to be a candidate for the ammonia dosing. I mean, who would be a candidate for ammonia dosing if you got an established system and you've got perpetually low nitrates? I mean, is that kind of like what your the target would be in terms of taking the plunge on that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, in that case, maybe you've got a system where you can tell that the nitrate or the nitrogen content in the system is low because of coral coloration. And you're constantly having to dose nitrate now just to keep the concentration detectable. And that, of course, is a matter of the resolution of the test method that you're using. But detectable is kind of the magic word for so many different elements that behave in a nutrient type fashion in a recirculating system like this. So detectable is kind of the magic word, because sometimes that's the best that you can really do. And you don't want to spike the system with a massive amount of any nutrient and then let it go for several days.
Yeah.
You really want this to be one of those things where the more consistently you can be administering it to the system, figuring, and Chris makes a great point there, don't think you've got to go by somebody else's recommendation. Have that, you know, cut it in half.
Right. And be conservative about it.
And yeah, because in the end, the impact on the system is it falls on your shoulders and what you've just put into the system. If the whole system if you lose a bunch of fish or something like this, and then all of a sudden now you've got a bacterial explosion in the tank, and all of a sudden the corals start going down as a result of this increased amount of bacterioplankton in the system, then you really have only yourself to blame. So go be ultra, ultra conservative about it.
And here's another thing, dude. I mean, we've talked about this a lot offline. You know, even if you are a candidate, you know, for ammonia dosing, you know, let's say you got somewhat lower nitrate levels, but your corals are looking really good, you know, why would you even consider making that sort of change?
Yeah. When things are looking good, that's, there are two tendencies I find. There are people who get bored, and then that leads to complacency, and all of a sudden things start going down. Then there are people who look at it and think, oh, I finally got it dialed in. I'm not going to screw with this anymore. That's like Meckley. I mean, like Meckley gets these things dialed in, and he's happy because now he doesn't have to think about it.
Yeah,
it's one less thing, you know, to think about. And so achieving that condition of equilibrium, so to speak, or just happiness in the system overall, don't be ultra concerned with what you've read about aiming for this value or that value. Watch the coral and keep that. If you reach a concentration of anything where it seems to be the great concentration for that system, whatever that is, seek to maintain that unless you see something change.
John Wright's asking a good question. Why not just feed more, you know, fish food, coral food to get your nitrates up? Why dose nitrates, or why dose ammonia bicarbonate?
Because you may be in a situation where you are nitrogen limited, but you're not, but your phosphate concentration is already in excess. And you don't want to address a problem of one nutrient being deficient by hitting the system with a large amount of organic material, saying to yourself, well, there's definitely nitrogen in this and there's going to be ammonia that's going to be generated. That's definitely true. There's a lot of other stuff in there that your system may not necessarily respond positively to. So if you hit the system with a bunch of food, trying to supplement the amount of nitrogen that's in the system, and then tomorrow, the same time, your ORP value is 40 points lower, that's because you got so much excess material in the system now that the bacteria are going bananas on, and probably your pH is going to be suppressed as a result of that. And lately, it's become ever more evident that that's not the best way to do it. You know, so you want to encourage the pH value to remain in a good spot. The more bacteria in the system, typically, the more acidic the system operates. You know, when you're relying exclusively on bacteria for nutrient conversion.
Yeah, I mean, I asked you the other day. I was like, what are your thoughts about feeding, you know, the tank more versus dosing phosphate? You know, it was the same kind of question in terms of, you know, dosing liquid phosphate versus just feeding the tank more. But it's because you've got more control over that phosphate piece of it.
Yeah, you do have more control. You don't have any control over what goes in when you're adding a complex organic material. And so yeah, and any kind of coral food or fish food and is going to do that. That stuff should be in there to feed the fish, not to try and kick your nutrient concentrations up or to feed the corals.
Jason Langer is asking, if running an algae scrubber, would dosing ammonia bicarbonate affect the amount of nitrate being removed from the water? Would the algae consume the ammonia instead of nitrate?
Yeah, they probably would to begin with, to the point where the ammonium becomes depleted, and then at that point they would probably move back over. But the system is not running exclusively on a turf scrubber. You have bacteria in the system, and if you've got live rock in the system, then you've got the ability or a deep sand bed and anywhere that there's the ability for denitrification to occur. So denitrification will continue to occur. Nitrate will continue to be consumed. The thing that you run into here is that by putting ammonium into the system, now you kind of wind up in a set of circumstances where more ammonium could or will eventually be produced than the system was initially dealing with. So this is another reason you want to ease into it so that the system is able to adjust to the change in the nutrient profile that's going in. And the more gradual that change is, then the more likely you're going to be able to catch what's going on. You know, so if you're paying attention, close attention to the nitrate concentration in the system, and your method of nitrate testing is adequate such that you can see when it's gone up one or two parts per million, then that, you know, don't wait for it to go up 5 parts per million. If it goes up 2 parts per million, now you understand, okay, I put the ammonium into the system, there was a cause and effect. Use that kind of information to go forward.
Here's another question. NSB Reese, would ammonia dosing be a good substitute to nitrate if you're combating cyano? Not sure I completely understand that, but I guess the question is, instead of dosing nitrates, would ammonia dosing help if you've got cyano in the system?
No, if you have cyano, you have some source of phosphate, whether it's bleeding out of the rock or the sand, or it's coming in from some outside source. Yeah, it's the phosphate seesaw. You know, you pull it out, the phosphate concentration in the system looks like it's dropped down to some value that you're happy with. 3 days later, it's back up almost to the same value it was, without you having done anything else, and you're wondering what happened here. It's leaching out of your substrate. So just as an example, but if I've got a system with cyanobacteria in it, I'm not looking at what my nitrogen concentration is preferentially. I'm looking to see what my phosphate is, because nitrogen's going in all the time But if I've got excess phosphate and I can't get that out, that tends to be when I start seeing cyanobacteria become more evident. It's always there.
Yeah, you and I were I was grilling you before the show about my cyanobacteria problem in one of my display tanks, and it's pissing the hell out of me. But I think I've got some phosphate that's leaching out of the rock. You know, it's hard to tell, but the fact that I've got this Carib Sea Life Rock, and the fact that it's like cement, no porosity whatsoever. Even though it's been in the system for a couple of years, just seems to be an algae magnet grower, whatever.
Well, so there's a way to determine to what extent that could be contributing to a phosphate issue in the system. And that's to mix up a fresh batch of salt water and do a phosphate test on that. Put, you know, get yourself whatever, a 2-gallon pail. Mix up some fresh salt water, do a phosphate test. Hopefully the phosphate comes back undetectable. Take a piece of your rock, put that in there, and let it sit for a couple of days. There will be some migration of phosphate out of that rock. Stir the water up 2 days later and do another phosphate test. And if you see that the number is higher than you'd like, then it's a good chance that other rock in the system is going to behave similarly.
So stir the water up in the container,
in the bucket with the
yeah. rock.
just to make sure that it hasn't stratified or anything like that. I mean, the extent to which it's going to stratify is probably nil, but do it anyway just to make sure.
Is that still possible, though, like after 2-3 years, that phosphates or whatever can still be leaching out of some, you know, some kind of rock? I mean, is that possible that there's that much phosphate in that? That it could like be leaching slowly over that long of a period of time?
It depends on how. Okay, I'll give you an extreme example. A few years ago, I was consulting for a company who had an account, an aquarium account, maintenance account, in a really nice home. And they were not the people who had put this tank together. They had somehow gotten the account from the company that had initially installed this system. And they brought me out there to have a look at this system. And dude, it was the algae tank from hell. And the homeowners were not happy. It was a pretty decent sized tank. It was big enough that the guy that I was working with got inside of it to hand me the pieces of rock. It was a room divider. It was a pretty good size tank. And that rock, they said to me, you can keep it. We're going to replace it with all fresh rock. We're done. We're done here with this rock. We can't, it's never going to correct itself. And that was still at the time when quality live rock was more accessible, yeah. I guess I'll say.
Yeah.
And so they give me all this rock. It's got to be 400 pounds of rock.
They gave it to you.
Gave it to me. I bring it back here. And we've got a decent sized display tank in the living room. It's a total of 540 gallons, but the display itself is like 340. So it's a pretty good sized tank. I put the rock in there, and it had been sitting outside bleaching for 3 years in the sun, and I had hosed it off. You know, we're on an aquifer out here. We're in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. Our water's really, really clean.
Yeah.
And, dude, that stuff grew algae like nobody's business to the point where it took 2 complete tank resets for me to get a handle on it. And that it was that rock. And that was mixed with some rock that had come from the Keys. That didn't do me any favors either, but that rock specifically just kept on. And I pulled some rock out and I tested it and I'm using Hawk test kits. They're I think very accurate. And so I was seeing, you know, when the color wheel matches up with a dark shade of blue, you know,
that's so phosphate.
Yeah, and the rock is still in there, and it's it's absolutely clean now. Now, one of the big changes that I made was that that tank initially was lit with LEDs, and then I swapped everything out and I put halides back over it, and everything went away. Mm. But that took some time. And so now, I mean, the rock is growing coralline. It's nice and clean. But yeah, that stuff had been sitting outside for such a long, long time. And we're in a fairly wet climate here. And it's not like it wasn't getting exposure to rain or anything like that. But anyway, even inside the system, it was such a long period of time for that rock to bleed that stuff out. I was running two huge protein skimmers. And so on and so forth. So yeah, the degree to which the rock was initially loaded, if it ever experienced a point in time where it was either exposed to a period of really elevated phosphate, or if it's composed of material that was mined from a shellfish bed, in which case that probably contributes to some of the phosphate right there. Mm. You know, so and I have no idea where any of that stuff, you know, comes from.
Right. Yeah. You know, and it could be different batch to batch in terms of dry rock. You know, I mean, who the hell knows? I guess there might be some differences. Ghouls is asking. I have cyano and phosphate is 0.02 and I'm adding phosphate to get it up and it's not working. So, I mean, in that situation, is the cyano just really sucking up the phosphate that's being dosed to the tank?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if I've got cyanobacteria showing in the tank, I'm not likely to be dosing phosphate. If the corals are starting to get pale, I'm going to be removing as much of the cyanobacteria physically, as I can. And just dealing with it in that approach for a period or for the period of time until things are looking better. I mean, a couple of different things that I've done in the past. You could incorporate a turf scrubber.
You've mentioned that a turf scrubber, you know, kind of like would be something that you could run to grow cyano in the system.
Well, it will grow cyano. Yeah it depends on the... It depends on the light spectrum that's used. I think that's been my experience. It's been my experience that certain light spectrums seem to encourage cyanobacteria to grow on the growing surface. That's not necessarily a bad thing. They're still doing something for you. And then, quite honestly, you'd prefer the cyanobacteria to grow somewhere outside of your display anyway. They're always there.
Right.
You know, they're in every system. It's just a matter of how intrusive is the cyanobacteria in your display.
So, all right, I'm seeing a couple of questions, Chris, about isolate MT, you know, dosing that. Gary Cumbo, can he give us more insight on how to dilute the isolate MT trace elements while running an algae scrubber along with ESV two part? So, all right, so Chris, I mean, basically, the isolated MT is a product that incorporates several minors and traces in it, versus dosing those individual minors and traces. So, just for those, I guess, Chris, that are not in the know in terms of that, what situations would you recommend dosing isolated MT versus individual traces and minors?
If you're never going to have an ICP test run, then I would be dosing isolate MT, and I'd probably be dosing it at the rate of one drop per 50 gallons per day in a well-stocked system. And I mean, when I say well-stocked, I mean a mature reef system that's pretty much wall-to-wall coral. Mostly, I'm going to say a lot of SPS, because the rate of nutrient uptake seems to be higher than with a lot of large polyp stonies. But if you're running a system that is not mature, and or just isn't stuffed with coral, one drop per 100 gallons per day. One drop, not 1 milliliter. 1 milliliter is 20 drops.
Very concentrated stuff.
One drop. So, and you can go higher than that. I mean, if you higher than the one drop per 50, if you've got a particularly robust growing system, and the nutrient or the rates of uptake are evidently quite high, then you could go higher than one drop per 50. And that can just be diluted in purified water. You don't have to, you will not be able to dilute that. You don't want to mix that with any solution containing, actually, let me think about this. Yeah, I wouldn't. I guess theoretically you could mix it with either a part A or a part B, and there wouldn't be, especially at the rate of one drop, there wouldn't be any kind of noticeable amount of precipitation that should occur. And it should actually be okay to do that. I have not tried that, but I can't think of a reason why it wouldn't work. But I would still, I'd still keep it
separate,
clean, clean, so to speak, and do it separately. But if you're going to ICP test, you ought to be using the individual solutions. And that's just because Isolate MT does something that it provides a number of trace elements, minor trace elements that are critical to photosynthesis. The other thing it provides is iodide, which is critical in my opinion to all zooxanthellate corals. The rate of depletion, which is to say the rate at which every individual element, and there are 10 elements in Isolate MT, is depleted in your specific system is going to be unique to your specific system. That being the case, Isolate MT is a good all-in-one, so to speak, for the purpose of keeping coral coloration up and ensuring that you're getting the critical elements in there for photosynthesis to occur. But eventually you're going to run into a situation where some of those elements that are in MT are going to be deficient relative to where they ought to be, and some of them are going to be in excess. And so if that's what you're going to do, then run an ICP every 6 months, you know, or just go ultra conservative and do one drop per 100 if you're concerned and you just say, I don't really want to mess with an ICP, then that's fine. But if you're going to do ICP testing, then you should be looking at the individual elements, because you really only want to be dosing what you need.
Right. It just gives you more control.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
So it makes it easier to make certain adjustments. If you're over, you know, pretty well on something or under on something else, dosing the, you know, Isolate MT would be kind of hard to get that stuff back into equilibrium.
You could never do it. I mean, it just wouldn't. It's just not possible to do it.
Right. So if you're doing like monthly ICPs or whatever on a regular basis, then it makes more sense to do the individual dosing. What about relying on heavy water changes, you know, to replenish trace elements?
Yeah, as long as the salt that you're using has got the necessary trace elements in there, and if you are able to determine that there's still detectable concentrations of some of those critical elements when you're running an ICP, then there's absolutely no reason not to do that. I think that in most systems, you're going to have a difficult time maintaining concentrations of iron and manganese just by doing water changes. And the nitrate concentration in people's systems is also impacted by the availability of molybdenum. So if you're not dosing molybdenum in a system, and if there's no molybdenum going in at all, then the nitrate concentration may be perpetually difficult to get a handle on. And I have no idea who else, you know, who puts what into their supplements.
Right.
And molybdenum is present in Isolate MT.
Getting back to algae scrubbers, you know, Rich Ross, I recently saw him on a live stream, and he said that he doesn't want to be in the business of farming algae. He wants to be in the business of farming corals. And you know, algae consumes trace elements. It's a so that adds complexities to it, right, man? I mean, you're when you're doing a scrubber, but it's consuming certain traces that you're going to have to adjust, right?
Yes, but that doesn't increase the complexity. That increases the rate of nutrient of depletion of those elements, and I'm saying this as from a farming pragmatic perspective. there, you don't have systems that are kind of just all reliant on one thing. A farm is kind of an ecosystem. It comprised of various things that are interacting with each other in differing amounts that are oftentimes influenced by the farmer. I can completely understand not wanting to, I can understand making that statement, but the other side of it is that it does not increase the complexity because you're still, those nutrient or those elements are still being depleted. And if anything, it's helping increase the pH stability in the system, and it's helping keep the concentrations of phosphate and nitrate reduced. And it's doing one other incredibly important thing, which is it's oxygenating the water. And the way most people, this is my perception, having had conversations with as many people as I've had, the tendency now in reef systems is not to have water crashing anywhere. It's for things to be serene and quiet, and for water going through the overflow to be silenced. And in order to do that, it kind of has to be in a still state.
Yep.
So it's not like 25 years ago when we were all using bioballs and wet dry filters. You know, at that point in time, the water oxygenation was encouraged because you had all of this water exchange with the atmosphere. And that has changed quite a bit. What a scrubber does for you is it helps oxygenate the water. I mean, one of the things I'm going to be doing coming up here is running a test system where I'm going to be using a GHL, was it the Profilux?
Controller, yeah.
And putting the oxygen probe on that and watching oxygen, ORP, and pH as a function of temperature and salinity, but mostly as a function of the maturity of scrubbers. And I want to see if I can keep oxygen in the system more or less saturated 24 hours a day while keeping the tank pretty much as quiet as physically possible, because this is also in my living room. and we like it quiet around here. And so the scrubber is doing something really important, which is helping keep the oxygen content in the system up. And if you're not, even with a protein skimmer, injecting air from the surrounding atmosphere, how many times I hear people starting about a month ago, you know, usually it's May timeframe through the end of the summer. This is the period of time when people have closed up the house. They're running the AC. It's too hot outside for them to have their windows open for a lot of exchange with the outside atmosphere. pH levels start to run depressed. The oxygen content in the system, I think, it bottoms out a little bit lower at night as well. And that's not helpful for the coral's longevity, for sure. It's probably not really good for the fish, even with a lot of surface agitation through wave makers and whatever else you want to put in there. You still don't have that crashing movement, and you're not going to get that that's not the point of running a scrubber. The point of running the scrubber is to actually get some of the oxygen back into the system so that it is oxygenated effectively 24 hours a day. So that's the other benefit of it. And so that would be my, you know, I do not run 100% bacterial dependent systems because they tend to run acidic because the bacteria are respiring and they're pumping out carbonic acid, and so the system pH is constantly low. Yeah,
dude, man, now you got me thinking about putting that scrubber back online. I've had it online twice. I'm taking it offline twice, and I'm freaking thinking about doing it a third time because the second time I did it, it really helped crater my nutrients, and I guess I wasn't staying on top of what it was doing. So I had a situation where my phosphates just like dropped down to like near zero, and I had some paling in terms of the corals and stuff like that. But sure. You know, I hear what you're saying. I hear that you know, it's gonna, you know, especially with me in a system that I seem to have a you know, an issue, yep, with cyano. It would be nice to have a repository for that cyano that I don't give a crap about. What I'm also hearing from you is that it probably makes sense if you're running a scrubber, or maybe it doesn't, but it would help to be doing regular ICP testing.
Yes, it will definitely help to do regular ICP testing with a scrubber, because that's going to tell you to what extent you need to really be dosing some of those really critical elements. You know, I mean, out of what's in MT, you've got a total of 10, one of them being iodide, which is an outlier here in this instance. But the rest of them are all critical to photosynthesis. Those are the ones you really want to be paying attention to. You know, iron, nickel, manganese, molybdenum, selenium, vanadium, zinc, cobalt. The ICP, as long as you're working with an ICP provider who can give you adequate resolution, then that's a critical thing. You know, I mean, and so, yeah, it's helpful to be running ICPs in that regard.
CJ's Aquariums, is there any merit to not cleaning your algae scrubber as long as possible, leaving it to grow?
No. Algae grow fastest right after they've been cropped. So if you want to kind of mitigate the impact on the system as far as the nutrient stability is concerned, depends on the type of scrubber that you're using. But if you're using one of these scrubbers that's got a screen that's illuminated on both sides, if you can manage it, scrape one side of the screen, wait a week, scrape the other side of the screen, or wait 2 weeks and put them on an opposing 2 week schedule. No, there is no benefit. It's like when your lawn is just freshly mowed, you know, the plant that 2 days later, the grass looks like you didn't mow it, kind of a thing.
Right.
They rebound from being cropped. It's just a matter of kind of the natural way that algae is grazed upon. It's grazed upon. You never fully get rid of it. It's always there, and it just will rebound and come right back. So no, I would not let it go as long as possible. I would have a schedule. You know, if you can manage it, work it into your routine every other week, kind of a thing.
You know, so I've also been using your Remediate, right, and primarily to keep my nutrients in check. You know, to keep the nitrates at a certain level and help with the phosphates. How does that come into play when you're dealing with a cyanobacteria issue?
The cyanobacteria, when cyanobacteria become more evident in a system, it's generally an indication that there's an excess of some nutrient, and phosphate is the one that's most likely going to be the offender there. What the Remediate will do is it'll take the latent organic material that's in the system that may be being broken down gradually, and it'll increase the rate of breakdown. And at that point, the idea is that the bacteria is going to be fed upon. It's in a planktonic phase there. It's basically going to be removed from the system by suspension feeders like corals and so forth. It's also going to be pulled out of the system by your skimmer. You should be running a skimmer. I think just my point of view. I've seen more problems in systems that don't run skimmers.
I tried running one of my systems without a skimmer, and that didn't freaking work out at all.
No. It on paper, it's one of those on paper things, you know, where you read something and someone says you shouldn't have to use a skimmer. No, a skimmer performs such a critical function in a recirculating aquatic ecosystem that to not run one is, and to not have access to one, because by the time you realize, now it's going to be 3 months before this problem is fixed, because your skimmer has to break in. And the problem persists, and you know, and now you've wound up with God knows what in the system, and it's all because you didn't want to run a skimmer for some reason. And so, you know, skimmers in my experience, especially in aquaculture, are critical.
Yeah.
You know, I know that there are people who run scrubbers and people who run mud systems and so forth who tell you, no, look, you don't need to run a skimmer. Look how beautiful my aquarium is. dude, you are the one in a million, because everybody else who has tried to do it has not made their tank look like yours, or very few of them. You know, it's just, it's so unlikely.
So I mentioned dosing your remediate. Why not carbon dose versus dosing bacteria? What's the...
You could do that too. I mean, you've got pre-existing bacteria in the system.
Right, so
for
carbon
sure.
dosing, you're basically adding fuel to the, you know, to the bacteria you already have to help them multiply versus adding new bacteria.
Assuming that they're carbon limited to begin with, that's when carbon dosing kind of comes into play. If you're running a system where you don't do a lot of feeding and there's not much in the way of organic material entering the system, then yeah, carbon dosing can be useful because it's providing those bacteria a source of carbon that they may require. But if you're running a scrubber, running carbon dosing tends to lead, again, to a more acidic system because you're now encouraging the bacteria to proliferate. You know, you're giving them something that they didn't have enough of previously. Now you're going to see an increase in the bacterial content in the system, and at the same time, you're going to see a tendency for the system to run a little bit lower as far as the pH is concerned. So you can do either. You can do both. As far as remediate or carbon dosing is concerned, remediate is unique though. They're not remotely the same thing. Although they do kind of achieve a little bit of the same thing. Remediate helps convert nitrogen into a form that's more readily utilizable. But yeah, so not really the same thing, but you absolutely can dose carbon in a system if your nitrate is just out of control and you want to give that a try and you're not feeding. You
know. Right. But there is a risk associated with that too, right? I mean, carbon dosing, if you're too heavy-handed with the carbon dosing, then that could certainly spell trouble.
You know, overdosing anything is including water itself is not a good idea. You can take anything to an unhealthy extreme, and I think you're gonna. I'll just speak specifically for the carbon that we produce here, Activate. I don't see the inherent danger of dosing that as the instructions state, because I wrote the instructions, so I know what they say. As long as people are following the instructions and as long as they're watching the stability of the system and they're making a personal call, you know, they're making the call themselves. Again, like I'll refer back to Chris saying, yeah, I dropped the ammonia recommendation in half. You know, yeah, that's what you should be doing when you're putting anything into the system to start out with is going very, very conservatively.
I want to jump back to a comment that Jason Langer made earlier, and the comments, I started dosing my Captivate supplements based on Chris's recipe for my system a month ago. When would I send in sample to Reef Labs to see if the recipe is holding up? So, you know, he's basically, you know, asking the question, he's utilizing, I'm assuming, your calculator, right? Your trace element calculator. Can you give folks, Chris, just a kind of a brief overview what that calculator is all about? And it's not available on their website right now, or is it? No, okay.
Nope.
You got to explain that one.
I will explain it gladly. I would rather do the data entry myself, which takes me 5 minutes, and send back the interpretation to the client. They're going to get. So this is what happens, everyone. You send me a link to your ICP report. You must provide me with the net system volume. I got to have that. And it would be really helpful if you'd provide me with the average alkalinity value in the system as well. That's useful information from the context of running the interpretation. What happens is I enter the values that were reported by your ICP provider into this calculator, and it basically determines what the salinity value of your system is based on the sum of those ions that were entered. So it's a calculated value, which is still an extremely accurate way of doing it. Then it's going to, let's say that your salinity comes back low, at 32 or something like this. It's going to tell you, this is what your salinity is, the concentration of all of these elements that were reported in the ICP report. This is the concentration that was entered. This is the concentration that that element would be at if we took seawater and slid the salinity to 32. So it's not looking at your report, your sample, and comparing it to full strength standard seawater.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why that's relevant. I often see ICP reports where the recommended values of the range of values for an ion fall within a range that I'll say is based on bias, their own bias. It's not based on the salinity of the sample. Now, there are a couple of ICP providers that do it that way, that actually say, I forget exactly what wording they use, but it's evident to me when I look at the value that I've calculated and the value that they're saying it ought to be, that that's how they're doing it. Whether or not they've always done it that way, I have no idea. Or that's a more recent thing. But that's the way that I've always done it. So what happens next is you are going to get an email from me. The Excel document is going to be attached with all of your data. There's going to be a bulleted explanation in within the body of the email that says, these are the values that were elevated. This is what you should do. And these are the values that were deficient. This is what you should do. These are things that you should be concerned with. So please read the entirety of that bulleted piece of work. It'll take you probably, I don't know, 3 minutes to do it. But you are given the full explanation as to also how the analysis has been interpreted. That also provides you with the immediate dosing requirements. So if your system was deficient in calcium, for instance, I'll use iron instead. If your system was deficient in iron, it's going to tell you you need X number of drops, probably one, of isolate Fe to bring your iron value up to the standardized value. And the standardized value, again, is that value that your value would be at that 32 parts per thousand in seawater. You get that whole list on one tab. The next tab over tells you how to make the dilute master dosing solution. Tells you how many drops you need to add to that solution. You're able to change the values as far as the default is you're going to dose for 30 days and you're going to make a gallon worth of solution. If you want to dose for 15 days, change that value in the field to 15. If you want to make 500 gallons of dosing solution to go over that 15 days, change that value. And it's going to change the values that it calculates, but it tells you exactly how to go ahead and put that solution together as well. And almost all of the isolate, minor, and trace element solutions are compatible. Actually, they are all compatible in the same solution. There are a couple of the major element solutions that they're not compatible with because there will be some degree of precipitation that can occur. But then the third piece of this is that next month, let's say you run an ICP and you send me the report, I'm going to go back and look at your previous ICP interpretation that I did. I'm going to see what the values that were calculated for your master dosing solution were, and I'm going to transcribe that onto the new sheet, and it's going to adjust the dosing for your next master dosing solution. So if you, I'll use iron again, let's say you'd been dosing iron, but your iron still comes in as below the target value. Say you were dosing two drops, this is for a particularly large system. It might tell you to add a drop. So instead of you dosing two drops this month, it's telling you to dose three drops.
Yeah.
That's based on what your dosing solution calculations were from last month. And the longer that you go on doing it this way, theoretically, the more accurate that master dosing solution kind of becomes to address the values that of the rates of depletion in the system. Now, things change in systems all the time, excuse me. And so it's not like, you know, there's a there's a target value somewhere out there, and eventually you're going to get there. That value is moving all the time.
Yep.
It moves based upon so many different aspects of what's going on in the system, but you're still attempting to keep the values as close as possible to the standardized values. You don't want to be really, really high, and you kind of want to make sure that those critical ions are above the constant, or are they're at a concentration where they're at least detectable by the ICP provider. Again, this, and this is going back to the resolution, go with an ICP provider who gives you the resolution that you really want. And that way those values are meaningful to you, because if you're being given a report where the concentration of this element is much lower than the resolution of the ICP system can provide you, then that's an element where it's a question mark for you at best, because you just don't know. You know, where is it exactly? You have no idea. So that's how you do it. And so why the Excel file is not on the website anymore is just because it is faster for me to enter the data myself, and rather than someone say, hey, did I do it right? And then I got to go back in and look at it. And I would just rather do the work for everyone, send back that interpretation. Again, it's no charge. Usually you'll get it back from me in 1 or 2 days after I get the link. I think that's also really, really useful, because it provides some context into what do these values really mean? What do I need to be concerned with? What's, you know, like a great example is let's say that your sulfate concentration is jacked up like 10%. Well, that's a big deal. If your sulfur is really high, if your sulfur is really high and your magnesium is really high, there's a good chance that you've been dosing a lot of mag sulfate in your system. If your sulfur is high and your magnesium is low, it could be that you've been dosing a lot of mag chloride or some other, or calcium chloride or some other chloride, to the point where the chloride concentration has reached a point where it's so far out of balance with the sulfate that it shows off as a big discrepancy. So there's definite value to getting an ICP run. And even if it's once every 6 months kind of a thing, or once a quarter, for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, you want to make sure that the ratios of all the major elements are as close to where they should be as possible. Hopefully the salt that you're using is providing you with that. If it's not, you need to consider what you're going to do about it.
Are there certain elements that, you know, let's say you're getting back ICPs, you know, and there's certain elements like manganese or cobalt or iron where you're always getting zeros. Is that something that you really need to be concerned about in terms of dosing that stuff versus other minors and traces that potentially might be more important to make sure you're not zeroing out on?
So in my mind, the ones that are critical to make sure that are at a detectable level are going to be the 9 that are in MT. You know, iodide is very easy to go ahead and adjust whether or not you do it with MT, but the rest of those elements are I think very important.
Can you rattle them off?
Yeah, cobalt, copper, iron, manganese, nickel, molybdenum, selenium, vanadium, and zinc. So it's 9.
Yeah, copper. Copper. I just started dosing myself based on your recommendation. I think I started with one drop, and I did an ICP, and I got 0 back on it. So I guess I'm gonna try 2 drops.
Sure.
In 30 days.
Right. Right. Yes. Yeah. It's incredibly powerful stuff. Yeah. This is the other thing. I mean, the isolate solutions are quite concentrated.
Yes, they are.
So those are the ones that I would be most interested in to make sure that I was keeping them at a detectable concentration.
All right. So what you're sending back, does that also include the recommendations for making that cocktail with multiple?
Yes, yeah, that's yeah. So there's a tab, there's a summary tab, which is what the screen opens up to when you open the file. The summary tab just tells you everything, where your values compare to the standardized seawater sample. The next tab over gives you the immediate dosing requirements. It tells you whether something needs to be addressed or not. The third tab, and it tells you how much to add. The third tab is the master dosing solution calculator that tells you this is what you're going to add as far as your 30-day master dosing solution. And again, you can change that value if you're going to be, if it's going to be 60 days until you run the next ICP, then, you know, change it to 60 days.
Macto S Fam, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly. Will Hannah Copper Checker be able to read low values? If you're not ICP, you probably should be ICP testing to know what you're in terms of your copper levels, right? Versus a hobby grade test kit.
Well,
I mean, copper, you don't want to mess with copper.
The concern that I would have is that the resolution of the copper test kit isn't high or isn't low enough to detect a concentration that is meaningful to the coral, but isn't toxic. So this is one of those things where I would almost say, do an ICP test first, and then I don't want to say dose blindly, but if you're going to dose something and you're not testing for it, then you really ought to be like super conservative. This comes up a lot with ICPs that don't include fluoride as a parameter. There are people that I've spoken to that I've done interpretations for, and I got to say, it's so important to read what I write in the body of the email as opposed to just open up the Excel file and go right to that master dosing solution and go, yep, this is all I needed. Because what winds up happening is if you have an older copy, this is the other reason that it's not on the website anymore. I have two copies, two different versions of the file.
Yeah, you kept changing
I change it all the time. Yeah. When I see that I want to upgrade it, I change it all the time. I've got one that is for ICPs that provide a fluoride value, and I've got one for ICPs that don't. And the reason that I started that was that people were not reading what I was writing in the body of the email. They went right to the master dosing solution, which gave them the amount of drops of isolate F that they needed in their system, assuming the value is actually zero. Well, they don't know what the value was because the ICP provider didn't provide them with that value. So instead of reading what I write in the body of the email, which is one drop per 100 gallons per day net system volume, which is ultra conservative, they go right to that thing and say, oh, 148 mils? Okay. 148 times 20. No, 20 drops. Now, I've told you to do one drop per 100.
Yeah.
You got to read, man. You got to read. These are professional.
No shortcuts.
Yeah, this is professional stuff here. We're talking about stuff that was formulated for commercial aquaculture, big systems. And I'm really verbose when I write labels, and I'm not going to apologize for it. because that's information that needs to be conveyed. You know, so
you're putting it out there.
Yeah, so I take the longest time that it takes me during an interpretation is actually customizing that bulleted section that goes into the body of the email, because I've got to adjust that for every single different ICP interpretation that I do. So I spend about 15 minutes doing that. It takes me about 5 minutes to do the data entry on the – actually, probably not even that long – on the Excel file itself. So please be mindful that it's taken me a quarter hour to write this interpretation for you. Please read it. Please. And don't overdose your system with anything. But for God's sakes, don't do it with fluoride.
Yeah, that's playing with fire.
Or copper.
You know, so not all companies that have the trace element dosing allow you to combine all traces in a cocktail together. How is that unique with Captivate?
I will not say.
a trade secret?
I have no idea. I don't know how other people formulate their products.
I know. That is always your answer, man. I don't know what the other guy does, but I know what I my know. Stuff is like.
Right. I am not privy to their formulations. I have no idea. I don't test anybody else's product.
I should have known that was going to be a stupid
question. No, I don't know. I don't know why. I just know that mine can. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It saves people money because you don't need 12 dosing heads to dose a trace element cocktail.
Yeah, and their simplicity really rules. First of all, the more apparatus you have on any system, the more chances of something just taking a dump on you at the most inopportune time. And so streamlining, and so this is why, again, farmers do not intentionally make things ultra complex, because eventually there's going to be a moment when there's a failure that could be absolutely catastrophic. And especially when you're farming something and it's your livelihood, the more stuff you have keeping the system running, this is not a space shuttle, but it almost requires that level of care. But to really increase the number of pieces of equipment that are in control of something is just increasing the number of chances of something going wrong. So yeah, getting it all into one solution is far more, I think, preferable to doing it the other way, dosing everything individually. That, no way, man.
So I know how Chris is going to answer this question from Reef Keeper. Does Chris have an ICP company he prefers as far as dialing in his cocktail?
Nope. Nope. I don't. My recommendations. All right. So lately, I again, please go to the website. Please go to my website and down. Probably, I'm not sure where it is. All right, so that's not going to help you. Somewhere on the main Captivate page, it's either at the top, there's a menu, and there's an ICP fee, option on the menu. You can drop that down. Somewhere on the site, though, there is an explanation about my thoughts about ICP analysis. And because this is a question I get a lot, which ICP company should I use? So I go into some detail there, and I'm sorry, it is rather lengthy, but you'll see when you read what's written there why I took the time to actually write what I wrote. One, you want fast turnaround time if possible, because that gives you a view to the system as recently as possible. You know, so if it's a long, long time, if it's a couple of weeks, if that's the best that it can be, then that's kind of what you're stuck with. If you can find someone who gets the results back to you more quickly, within a few days, that's preferable. They have to be providing you with legitimate results. Those values need to be pretty darn close to being correct. The only thing that I can
But how do you
advise,
know that though, right? I mean,
well, all right, so with major element dosing actually, or testing is actually how I would do it. Get a hold of some good, and you should have some good standard test kits, you know, that you rely on to verify the values that are being provided by your electronic monitoring equipment or your ICP provider or anything like this. Those test kits, as long as they're accurate test kits, and accurate test kits, there are some good accurate hobbyist grade test kits on the market, and there have been for a long, long time. What I use are laboratory grade test kits made by a company called Hawk. I'm sure I've mentioned in past discussions. You want to, at the time that you pull the sample for your ICP, you want to test for the major elements that are critical and that you can get these good test kits for: magnesium, calcium, potassium. If you, and strontium,
Potassium.
absolutely.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
What about phosphate?
Sure. I mean, phosphate's going to. Phosphate may potentially change somewhat because it's a nutrient. But by the time it gets to the, like, all right, I wouldn't be, if I'm getting an ICP analysis wrong, the phosphate is, I don't care what the phosphate comes back at. You know, like, to me, that's of no interest because it's a nutrient. That concentration may have changed, and it, you know, if it changes by 10%, that's a fairly good amount because there's not that much phosphate in the system to begin with. But perform a test with reputable test kits. And if you get an ICP result back that seems off, and I mean really off, contact the ICP provider and ask them. Just say, hey, look, I'm just curious. I ran an analysis using my own test kits. Now, I understand that I can't see the resolution that you can see, but this number seems off, or these numbers seem off. And use that as your benchmark. Certainly go by the recommendations of other people that you trust that are using an ICP provider that maybe is close to you. And if as long as everybody is getting results that they feel like are accurate results, then you know that's a good candidate. And so look for those two things, and absolutely ask questions. If you're unsure about a value that comes back, I mean, one that comes back all the time that I see is that where there's the greatest obvious immediate discrepancy is when someone emails me back and says, whoa, my salinity meter, my probe was telling me that the salinity was 36.5 and this came back at 32.5 or something along those lines. There's some massive discrepancy in salinity. Again, ask questions, ask the ICP provider, you know, for some explanation. And they may very well come back to you and say, ah, yes, your device is off. That's legitimate. You know, if they come back and say, no, we tested it, we verified, this is how the process is done. And, you know, they're providing a service. They ought to be willing to give you some, the explanation that you need to satisfy your curiosity about it. You paid them for this thing. You know, they owe that to you.
What about trying to sync it up with the, you know, the standards that you have in terms of the salt that you're using for your aquarium? You know, I mean, in other words, send in a clean sample of freshly mixed salt water to the ICP company, knowing what you know in terms of how all the different, you know, elements measure out in that salt mix, and kind of using that as a benchmark terms of the reliability of that company.
You got to know that the salt mix published, that the values published on the salt mix by the manufacturer are legit. That's part one. Part two is you have to make sure that you mix the salt up, not necessarily according to what you think it needs to be, but actually to the salinity value. Not, I always measure out 50 gallons and this is the 50 gallon mark on my vessel. No, that value may not be correct. Hopefully, you're mixing the salt water up to the point where you say, okay, the salinity is at 35, I'm happy.
Right.
You know, that's the number you're going for. It's not anything else. It's not, I always do it to the same level. Mm-mm. Because if you do it that way, then the salinity of that water may be above or below. Now, the manufacturer has stated somewhere on their label that the concentration of like calcium is supposed to be 421 or something like this. You submit your sample, it comes back and they're telling you that your calcium concentration is actually 400, and you're going, what, you know, what's going on here? But then what you're missing is, oh, I didn't mix the salinity up to 35. I mixed it up to 33.5 or something like this. So you really need to be mixing it to the salinity. The value that you're actually targeting. Otherwise, you need to understand the context of what the values are that they're providing you, and actually how they actually relate. It's not just looking at it and saying, you know, oh, dude, my calcium is only 390. Well, if your salinity is 31 parts per thousand, then maybe 390 is the magic number. I mean,
yeah,
you know, it's you got to take it in context.
You know, again, it's all about looking at the corals in your tank and not going too crazy in terms of course correcting if your corals are looking happy in the tank, right? I mean, you don't want to go overboard in terms of making any major changes to what you're doing. You got to look at the animals.
This is why there is no substitute for experience. I mean, I've said this before, I'll say it again. My Bible for taking care of any of my systems whenever I have a question is looking at Julian and Charles's reef books, because they are, there's not a doubt in my mind that the information in there is not only pertinent, but it's correct and it's useful. And so that helps me despite the experience that I have. Yes, that's my favorite one of the, wait, is that three? Yes.
Yeah.
That's my favorite one of the three, without a doubt. And some of that information at this point, people are going to say it's a little bit outdated. It doesn't really matter. The core of what's being conveyed there is still the core of being a successful, of putting together a successful system. And so, that in combination with the bona fide experience and the appearance of the corals is, that's the standard, you know, because if you're looking at it and at the system and you're saying, well, I don't understand this, all my values seem to be right, but my corals don't look so good. Something's got to change.
Right.
Something's wrong.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Different topic. Just changing gears a little bit. Jason Langer talking about Propagate, the amino acid blend that you have.
Yep.
He's asking, can it, and I had a similar question to you about Remediate, can it be made into a solution and auto dose daily? I mean, I guess my question was, can it be pre-mixed and stored and you know, for a tank sitter to be able to dose it on a daily basis? But start with Propagate. Can you dose
blended,
it?
Yeah, absolutely. You can, if you're going to, okay, if, all right, in your situation, if you're going to have a tank sitter, who's going to be dosing the system, I guess.
Right. I basically, you know, I dose Remediate on a daily basis, like every morning. It's not imperative that a tank sitter do that in terms of the time of day, but, you know, I'd like to pretty much continue dosing it while I'm away.
Just keep it in the fridge.
Right.
In your case, keep it in the
fridge.
Right.
Just mix up the normal dosage in salt water, right? Or no, RODI water. Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
No, I mean, if I was going to do it with salt water, I would make sure it was salt water that was freshly mixed, because I don't want.
Probably RODI is cleaner and yeah.
You know what? If you guys have tap water, that is, are you on city water? Or you're on well water where you
no,
are.
No, I'm not near a city, man. I'm like
right. That I was going to say. Well, I mean, I don't know how they do it up there, but no. I mean, our tap water here. I would tell you tap water first of all because it's clean. And there's no reason not to do it in tap water. I could see there being a little bit of degradation if you went ahead and put it into RODI water, where maybe I wouldn't want to do it that way, but that's a good second best. If I was going to do salt water, I would mix up freshly made salt water in a clean vessel. All you're trying to do is keep bacteria out of that solution until you've run out of solution.
So you're saying the optimal way is to mix up, is to put Remediate in freshly mixed salt water?
For Remediate, yes.
Okay, what about Propagate?
For Propagate, I would do that in tap water.
Tap water.
But as long as you got no chlorine, you know, if it's clean, if it's good tap water. If it isn't, then use salt water, but use clean salt water that did not come out of the tank. And so all you're trying to do is mitigate bacteria getting into that Propagate solution.
Right.
There are no preservatives in any of the dry stuff. There's no preservatives at all. I don't keep preservatives in our facility. Figure that the warmer, once you put something in a solution, the warmer the solution is and the longer it sits there, the more likely it is going to develop a bacterial film. Not that that's going to be harmful, but that's not really what you want. So just try to avoid that.
What about you know, reusing, you know, so I've got Remediate in a Tupperware little bin, you know, so I'm basically trying to keep it as separate as possible from air, moisture, what have you, but over time it seems to get a little clumpy.
That's fine.
It's still fine. Okay. So it's not losing any of its juice.
No, that stuff is in a form of, in a state of stasis. And without adequate nutrients, they're, if you start seeing the packet start to swell,
and that's,
then I would say, okay. Yeah. But if you're not seeing that, then, and I've never seen that either, but that would be the telltale sign.
Cockwasser. I can't believe we haven't talked about cockwasser yet.
Oh God.
What about cockwasser in terms of preserving that? I mean, that you don't want any air to come in contact with that, right? I mean, that will degrade the potency.
Yeah, quite possibly. It gradually will. That I package that exclusively in resealable zip top bags. When you open it, you take out what you need. You carefully close the bag back because that stuff gets everywhere.
Yeah.
Force as much air out of it as you can.
Right.
Seal it and just keep it in a dry location. You don't need to worry about, because it's sealed. You know what I mean? Like, but you want to keep it away from moisture because it will clump. You want to keep it away from exposure to the air because it will become gradually less alkaline.
What about the use of calc stirrers versus a drum? You know, so a calc stirrer, basically the concept is you're feeding it with RODI, auto top off water. So you're running that through that. You know, I've had discussions with Meckley about this, but, you know, I think the thinking is that it that will dilute the cockwasser by constantly running RODI through it. Right. Versus using the method that, you know, I follow, Meckley's method, which is a bin, and pretty much putting the amount of cockwasser that you you need in terms of in the powdered form, filling it up with RODI water and then dosing it via dosing foam.
I've done it both ways. When I first started in the industry and I was working for a company where we were having some, we were building protein skimmers in addition to the other things that we were doing. I'm not going to mention the company by name because it's probably some kind of, I don't know, it's probably not a good idea. But anyway, we had a lot of acrylic tubes hanging around, and we were working with a company who was doing some acrylic fabrication for part of this filtration system that we were also doing. I put together a calc stirrer that used a really good laboratory magnetic stirring platform made by Corning. I think if you look for one of those now, they're probably $500 used. You could adjust the spin rate on that stirrer with a big magnet, like probably with a 1-inch magnet bar. And I feel like I might've used a cross, but I had at the bottom of this reactor, a Teflon disc. And that was meant to mitigate the amount of wear that the magnetic stirring bar actually had on the bottom of that acrylic. So it was glued to the bottom. And I think that disc was, I mean, it was wafer thin, but it was probably at a 3-inch diameter. Uh-huh. So what I had was the water line from a purified water system discharging inside this vessel. It was entirely sealed with thumb screws and all this up at the top. It was glued down at the bottom. And the discharge, the tubing, it was just 1/4-inch compression tubing. It was cut so that it was probably only about 1/2 inch off the bottom of the interior of this vessel. And there was a crap load of calc wasser in there. What would happen is I would keep the magnetic stirring platform on the lowest speed that I could reliably make sure that the magnet was continuing to spin and I could hear it.
Yeah.
So I knew that it was working. And so I had water coming in from the feed line, and I had water exiting out to a, at the time, a float valve. Kids, don't do this at home because this is not how I recommend dosing calc wasser. But now I would do it differently. Now I would actually do it with a solenoid, but it would still work the same, largely the same way. But anyway, at any rate, what wound up happening was the purified water was coming in. It was discharging almost at the bottom of the interior of that vessel. And what I got was a fluidized effect where that calc wasser was constantly being fluidized. It looked like an old fluidized sand filter, except it was 3/4 of the way calc wasser up to the top. I would adjust that the speed of the magnetic stirring platform down as the amount of Kalkwasser decreased inside that vessel. Because what would happen is you'd start off with a super heavy milky layer of Kalkwasser in the bottom half of this thing. As time goes by and more Kalkwasser is leaving the vessel, the level of Kalkwasser inside that vessel starts floating up to the top, and the overall, the solution itself starts to become discolored, whereas it was largely crystal clear above the Kalkwasser before. Mm. So, and again, I could see this because the acrylic tube that I was using was, it was like, I don't know, 5-inch diameter extruded. I still have a bunch of them. That water discharge down near the bottom, I think, was critical because it made sure that that purified water was always interacting with the Kalkwasser that was inside that stirring vessel. And so I never had a problem maintaining pH with that. Oh, I mean, that worked exceedingly well. Yeah. I mean, I would do something like that now. The problem that I ran into, this is why I would use a solenoid instead of the float valve thing, is you don't want to pressurize an acrylic vessel with water pressure coming off of your well pump or anything like this. I probably had that thing in operation for less than 6 months, because I'm sure it was showing signs of stress from wanting to just blow the entire thing, because it's kind of like a mini, bomb inside your aquarium cabinet. Because when that float is up at level inside the aquarium, there's still water pressure acting on the calc vessel. So it would pressurize in there. Again, kids, don't do this at home. But it worked really, really well. And so I don't think there's any one right way to do it. I think there are a lot of ways that you can make it work. And certainly it takes a lot less space to do a calc stirrer if you can get one that will work reliably for you. But there's an investment. And I build almost everything that we use here from scratch. I don't like buying stuff. It's really unusual. Unless I have an emergency, then I call up Todd at Champion and say, hey, I need blah, blah, blah. What do you have?
Yeah.
I did that with protein skimmers a couple of years ago during that live rock algae fiasco. But I like building my own stuff. And so if I've got to have $600 into something, then, I can at least fiddle with it. And I don't feel bad if it breaks.
If it craps out on you.
Yeah.
All right, dude. So the last thing I want to talk about is coral snow treatments, and I've been kind of going back and forth on these things. I've done a few. I've stopped. I've done a few. I've stopped. Sort of like an algae scrubber for me. I've been dipping my toe in it. What do you think the advantages are in terms of coral snow treatments? My understanding is that it acts as a flocculant. Right, it could help, trap, organic compounds, detritus, what have you, and help remove that via mechanical filtration. I mean, if you're doing coral snow treatments, though, can that work against you in the sense that not all of the stuff that gets trapped or adheres to the flocculant gets exported from the system? Can that lead to a, an issue?
All right, so. In my mind, I look at this. So what we're talking about specifically here is the application of what's effectively micronized aragonite into the system. You put a spoonful of this micronized aragonite into the system, and it needs to be a high purity aragonite. But overall, what winds up happening is, and I'm going to speak exclusively here about not about the impact on alkalinity or anything like that. I'm going to talk about what the perceived visible impact is to the system. By doing this, the aragonite tends to bind with compounds in the water that are associated with discoloration of the water, which is why you wind up with what appears to be an improvement in overall water clarity after you've done this. I have often done it before closing up shop for the day or going to bed or something like this, depending on where the system is. And the next morning, of course, the water gets massively cloudy immediately.
Yeah.
The next morning is crystal clear, And so in that respect, it is useful. So I had had, there's a store up here in Clifton that I've known these guys for years. Absolutely Fish, wonderful, wonderful aquarium store, wonderful people. One of their managers asked me if I could source some of this for them because he was interested in trying it, and I wound up bringing it in, and I'd sent some to you up as well, I think.
Yeah.
But so the impact that it has on the system is that the increase in water clarity that happens, usually it's that next day, and you haven't done anything else to the system as far as the, in order to enact that change, as far as the impact on the system is concerned, and whether or not there's some sort of a potential detriment to removing those organic compounds from the water, your skimmer is going to be pulling a lot of that stuff out anyway. If the skimmer is not actually keeping the water as crystal clear as you would like it, then this is a way to kind of boost, I suppose, the ability of your system to actually export that stuff.
So there's no real downside to doing a coral snow treatment in terms of like there being accumulation of some sort of residue.
No, because the material itself is so fine that it largely winds up being remaining waterborne and gradually, I guess, just settles out and gets pulled out by skimmers and certainly if you're running mechanical filtration, that's a very fine, minuscule pore size, then I would expect that's going to be counterproductive because that's going to plug. But depending on the micron size of the material, I don't use roller mats or anything like that, so I can't say what the impact is. But we're talking about stuff that's around 2 microns, and so it's quite small. And of course, the micron size increases with accumulation of material. The other thing that you will see, especially again right at the beginning, is the live rock and the coral. You'll see a film that shows up, and that's the biofilm that's trapping some of that material. That's usually gone within a couple of hours as well. So again, by the time tomorrow morning rolls around, it's done.
There's no accumulation. That you're not in danger of accumulating biofilm on the rock. It's going to dissipate.
No, I mean, the way that it's meant to be used, you're not going to have any kind of an issue like that. Again, as with everything else, you could take that to an unhealthy extreme, I'm sure, but that's not the point. I mean, you know, it's there as an extra thing to assist you with doing that.
Any added benefit to coral snow treatments if you're using activated carbon and UV sterilizer?
So there won't. As far as activated carbon is concerned, I could see there being some actual trapping of the particles, depends on the carbon. I don't see them as being particularly running in the same area. I guess because the carbon is being used expressly for the means of reducing organic load in the system.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be overly concerned that there was going to be there's not going to be any kind of a negative reaction. That's one thing. As far as a UV is concerned, there should really be no impact on that, aside from if the sleeve is not clean to begin with, is not particularly clean, and it's accumulated a good film, then I could see a faster reduction in UV penetration through that quartz sleeve if there was enough of a film there to trap that material. But you know, I mean, a UV sterilizer is only effective as long as it's effectively getting the light through that quartz sleeve. So yeah, it's gotta be maintained. It's one of those pieces of equipment where it's like running an ozonator in a humid environment. Might as well just unplug it.
You know? Yeah.
I mean, as far as a UV is concerned, you just gotta keep on top of that, and that really shouldn't be a problem.
Reef Exotica by Luis Aceves is asking a question about just that. It's a comment, but I'll turn it into a question. Just added coral snow Microbacter 7 mixture, which is a bottled bacteria, to my tank this morning. The added bacteria is supposed to help with cyano, which I have a little bit right now. What are your thoughts in terms of adding a bacteria to the coral snow mix?
I have no idea what's in either of those things, but if you were going to take, for instance, the stuff that the aragonite that I do and mix that with remediate.
Yeah, what would that do?
You'd want to add nutrients at the same time. So I'll tell you, the cocktail to use there would be remediate, propagate, to provide the nutrients, and the flocculate, which is the micronized aragonite. You shake those things up and let them sit overnight. And that would give you effectively marine snow within a period of time. That's what you'd get out of it. I mean, like, that's marine snow in the oceanographic sense is particles of material that are settling through the water column. Typically they're associated with decaying dead plankton or other organic stuff falling through the water column. And as it falls through the water column towards the seafloor, it's colonized by microorganisms, by bacteria. And it winds up taking on this progressive kind of gumball, gobstopper, onion. I mean, they're basically like an amorphous structure where you've got all of these facets to it. And it's just, that's what marine snow technically is. And so this is why I say that you can produce it that way by mixing aragonite and bacteria and your choice of nutrients. As far as whether or not, like, that would not be my approach to deal with phosphate. My approach to deal with phosphate would be A, determine where's the phosphate.
In terms of like fighting cyano.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. If I've got cyanobacteria present in a system, I'm going to start looking for the smoking gun or guns.
Phosphate.
Is there a certain fish food that I'm adding to the system where I switch up what I put into the systems? Does one food more than another tend to elicit a response in the cyanobacteria where later on that afternoon there's cyanobacteria growing in some spot? And most systems, there tend to be certain locations in the system where cyanobacteria shows up. It doesn't just show up here and there. It shows up in specific spots. And so you can reliably go back to the same spot and look at it and say, oh, okay, well, you know, I'm not seeing it. That's good. Or, uh-oh, look at that. You know, and that's one thing is to determine where is that coming from. I'm going to do two things. If I've got cyanobacteria, I'm going to be proactive and reactive. Proactive, I'm going to determine where's the phosphate coming from. How can I get this out of here without it having a massive negative impact on the coral? Two, how am I going to get this cyanobacteria calmed down? And certainly the application of a number of different microbial blends will probably go ahead and get you towards that. Because what you're trying to do is you're trying to starve them.
Yeah.
Without starving the coral.
It's a delicate balance.
It absolutely is. And again, I say, this is an instance where a scrubber is probably really going to help with long-term maintenance. Because if you're in a perpetual state in which phosphate is problematic for you, then you really want to work hard on getting it out of there. Before you throw in the towel and just say, dude, I've had enough.
It's that constant battle though, man, because, you know, let's say you got a scrubber going and, you know, you got the cyano and the scrubber is going to bring down the phosphates, and then you've got, you know, near zero phosphates, and you're going to have to dose phosphates, right, to get those phosphates up, and that could potentially feed the cyano.
Yeah, but what you're trying to do there is you're just trying to dose phosphate to the extent that the coral coloration looks good and you're not seeing cyanobacteria.
Right. So it's a very fine line, I think.
But and that takes some fiddling around with.
Yeah.
But that's the point. You know, the point is that you're using the system to tell you, what do I need to do here? You know, do I need to add this? Do I need to not add this?
ACA Aquaculture, PNS bacteria helps tremendously with phosphate. We've been working with Hydrospace for 6 months, and the data says it works well. The only comment I'm going to say about, I hate to make this comment, but the stuff is pricey, you know, the PNS bacteria to dose that stuff, it can get pricey for a larger system. Yeah, a company called Hydrospace. But I have no doubt it's a good product. But dude, I've kept you long enough. It's been a great discussion as always. Well, any final thoughts, man, before we sign off here?
No, I thank you everyone for everyone who's watching this. I really appreciate it. I sincerely appreciate your continued interest and certainly in what I'm doing here at Captivate and what I have to say. And please always feel free to contact me with questions about the products. I handle all of our tech support and I'm the one who formulates everything. So I'm going to be the one who's giving you some guidance on how to proceed with things. And
folks can, Champion Lighting and Supply carries your stuff. I carry your stuff. Get it from Todd at Champion. You know, they're a sponsor. If they don't have something in stock, then you can go to Reef Bum to pick it up. But Champion should be the go-to. Where else, Chris, can folks find Captivate stuff?
I don't have it all over the place. Yeah. I deal with selective people who really are good industry partners. Yeah. So there's Ken out in California at High Tide.
Yep, High Tide Aquatics.
Yep, and saltwateraquarium.com. Yeah. There are a handful of other dealers that one of our distributors that handles the West Coast sells to, but they haven't provided me with the names of those people. So if you're happen to be a store who's using the product or selling the product in your store, then please reach out and provide me with a logo and your web address, and we'll get you up on the dealers.
And you could also get it at ACI Aquaculture.
Yeah, if you're selling the Reef Blueprint brand, yeah, then I can put you up there so people can actually see that you're selling the brand. But yeah, ACI, Champion, and Reef H2O. So as far as distribution is concerned.
Cool. All right, dude, man. Well, listen, Chris, thank you so much. And I appreciate you taking the time again to have this chat. I also want to take the opportunity to thank the sponsors one more time. Champion Lighting Supply, besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands, including Captivate. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through the website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. Polar Reef. Make sure to check out Polar Reef's new YouTube video that drops this Friday. Imagine winning a fully paid trip to New York to see the 17,000-gallon reef in person. Well, that's exactly what just happened. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polar Reef for video drop notifications. Polar Reef is known for some crazy giveaways, so make sure to follow them on social media. Fauna Marine. I do use the Fauna Marine Reef ICP Total Test Kit, which gives a quick, accurate, and easy overview of over 90 water values in reef aquariums, from macro elements to trace elements, pollutants. You get a complete overview with corresponding dosage and action recommendations. I'm personally now certified as a Fauna Marine ICP Test Advisor, so if you want to help with the interpretation of your test results, just pick me when you have that option. And big thank you to Paul, who's also who's the moderator, also the president of the Boston Reefer Society. Please join and support your local reefing clubs. They are so important to this hobby. Also want to let you know that all episodes of Wrapped Around the Reef Bum are available as podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Amazon. Next week, Wrapped Around the Reef Bum will be Tuesday, June 11th, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Mr. Chris Meckley from ACI will be on again. You can check out the full upcoming schedule of guests on reefbum.com under the YouTube section. Until next time, be safe and be well. Later.